Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. So nice to see everybody here. Friday, or no, this is not Friday now, it's now Tuesday. So I got so used to saying our Friday night party every Friday that Tuesday kind of threw me off. But nice to see everybody here. And before people came in, it was just a couple of us here and we were talking. And I was saying to our friends here, how Bhante Saranapala, actually, he has this meditation program in Mississauga. And before we started this one, I asked him about it. I was like, you know, I'm thinking, do you think it'd be a good idea to try one in Scarborough? I'm out there. He said, yeah, go for it. And he gave me this advice. He said, whoever comes, conduct the program. It's like, it doesn't matter, you know, whoever's there, conduct the program for them. It's a commitment. You have to be there every week, you know, no matter like what's happening, you've got to be there. So that was his advice that he gave me, you know, before we started this program. And so I was telling our friends, you know, sometimes in the winter it was just me and one person. You know, there's this friend. She's actually not here today, but she would come like often during the winter. Sometimes during ice storms, she'd come. And then sometimes there would be like a retreat going on over there. And at that time they were working in the attic here. So we'd be in like this conference room over there, which is very small. But, we would kind of go ahead and meditate there anyways. And so this was the kind of advice that Bhante gave. And I think it's very good advice. So today at the beginning, there were just a couple of us, and then somehow there ended up being, you know, maybe seven people. So you kind of never know who's going to come or what's going to happen. And so, you know, of course, our life is like this too. You know, of course, we undertake things with the best of intentions, you know, trying to do a good job, hoping that we're going to get good results. And yet we don't know if we're going to get good results right away or not. You know, sometimes things are like this. We start doing something and boom, right away, it's immediately successful. You know, other times we start doing something and it's just not getting off the ground. You know, it's just nothing seems to be working out with it. You know? Kind of could be, a project at work, could be a project at home, could be something else and it's just not seeming to happen. And so the thing that we have to take towards some of these things, number one, is a kind of attitude of steadiness. So, of course, not every project is worthwhile undertaking, but the project that we have here is training our minds, trying to train our minds to be happy, trying to train our minds to be peaceful, trying to train our minds so that they're like kind of what the Buddha calls a thoroughbred horse. Kind of you tell the horse to go and it just goes. Whatever you tell it to do, it does. So actually, my aunt right now, she sprained her ankle or something a couple days ago. So I called her to see how she was doing. And she has this new dog. It's like 3 months old. And she's training the dog. So right now, this dog just goes wherever it wants. And if it sees Kleenex, it loves Kleenex. So it like eats the Kleenex and chews the Kleenex up. And Kleenex goes all over the place, right? And, you know, I was asking her, so how do you, train this dog, And I was also asking her friend. She said, well, you tell it no when you don't want it to do something. And then when you want it to do something, when it does something well, then you give it a treat, you know? And so actually training our minds has overlap in this. You know, when we want our minds not to do something, then we have to restrain it, tell it, don't do this. And just like this kind of young dog, when it's kind of running all over the place, acting wild, it won't be happy with that necessarily. You know, not right away. For example, we really like to eat some kind of junk food. Okay, I knew a fellow once who liked to eat a whole tub of ice cream. Like, he would sit down with one of these like gallon tubs of ice cream, and he kind of admitted it. We were talking one time. He's like, "Yeah, I eat a tub of ice cream sometimes." He wasn't a big guy, had a fast metabolism. But supposing we sit down to eat a tub of ice cream and we want to stop that habit, if we've been using this habit as something we just go out to, then when we tell our minds not to do it the first time, it's not like it's necessarily going to pay attention. Kind of like this young dog, likes chewing up Kleenexes that are, left on the floor and just making this huge mess. Well, the first time we tell this dog really sternly, "No, young puppy, don't chew that Kleenex," it's not like from that time onwards that dog will just stop chewing up Kleenexes. It just loves to chew them up. But the thing about this is, when we apply these kind of two principles, there's a carrot and a stick to this. Tell this dog, "No, don't chew the Kleenex." You keep telling it that. Eventually it gets ingrained in its mind, "I'm not supposed to chew Kleenexes." But then we also don't just leave the dog at that, where we're just scolding it all the time. We also have to give it rewards, So it's not just the case that this dog, whenever it chews Kleenex, is getting yelled at, so now it's afraid to do anything. When it does something good, you also give it a treat. So then when that dog knows, okay, I'm not supposed to do this, this is what I'm supposed to do. There's rewards for this that come from this. And so in the same way, when we're training our mind, when we stop trying to, for this fellow, for example, if he doesn't want to eat this tub of ice cream, when he gives that tub of ice cream up, he has to replace it with something else. It's not like you just quit finding a source of pleasure or relief in one place, and then after that, you can just go without anything at all. So people usually give something up and grab onto something else. So when we're training our minds, what we try to do when we give up, or we're giving up here when we sit down to close our eyes, we're giving up our attachment to all kinds of things, which is why our mind zips off to the past. It's kind of, this really great thing happened in the past, and all of a sudden we're, 10 years, in the past, doing whatever we were doing then, something really great. But then we're attached to this memory from 10 years in the past, and it turns into something horrible that happened 10 years in the past. And now we're stuck there, reliving this terrible memory, And then sometimes it zips off to the future, to this really great thing that's going to happen. If we just, do this X, Y, or Z, maybe I should get up and stop meditating right now. Do X, Y, and Z so this great thing can happen in the future. And we're there for a while when we're meditating. And then before you know it, the future turns horrible. Turns into something absolutely terrible. And so this is what our minds are like when they're like this kind of young dog. Kind of, you have to keep this dog on a leash. If you let this dog, this young dog, kind of run wherever it wants. I was talking to my aunt yesterday, and she said, she has this big backyard. And I said, "Well, it must be really nice for your dog." And she said, "Well, we have to watch it because it doesn't know what its boundaries are yet. It doesn't know its proper range. So this dog, you just let it go wherever it wants. It can run into the road. It doesn't have really an idea of what happens on roads, and it can get hit." And so in the same way, when we train our minds, we have to know what our proper range is. We have to know when to tell our mind no. So when we're going and watching our breath, no is basically anything that isn't connected with the breath. And so we see this when our mind launches out to the past. It's usually through this temptation, like this dog chewing the Kleenex. It seems like something really great to chew on. But then after you've been chewing on it for a while, you realize, well, this isn't something all that great. So we jump into a memory that takes us to the past, to something great, and we're in there. And then before you know it, it turns into a nightmare. This is the same faculty that tempts us to go off, the same one that turns around and bites us. We jump into some amazing thing that's going to happen in the future, and before you know it, it turns into something terrible. Something just awful that's going to happen in the future in our heads. And this is the same thing. Kind of this, our mind racing outside of its proper range, racing out into dangerous areas, Racing out into the road, racing out into the neighbor's backyard where there's dangerous dogs. So what we learn how to do is put our mind on a leash. So we put our mind on a leash and we chain it to the breath. This is why meditation in some ancient cultures is called they called them yogis, because you yoke. You know, this yoke was this thing they used to tie, I think, ox to carts with. So then wherever this kind of ox went, it had to pull this cart. You know? So in the same way, we yoke our mind to our breath. So wherever it goes, it runs off of its range a bit, we bring it back to the breath. You know, the breath is a safe place. You know? But at the same time, we tell our minds, no, you know, don't go running off. You know, don't do that, mind. Bad mind, you know. We also have to give it treats. You know, so it's not just a case of disciplining ourselves with some harsh stick. There's also a lot of happiness to be found right here in the breath. So we learn how to make our breath pleasant. We learn how to spread pleasant feelings with our breath throughout our body, you know. So whenever our mind wanders off, we tell it no, but then when it comes back, we learn to reward it. We learn to think, okay, what's a really comfortable way to breathe right now? We learn to breathe in that way. You know? And when we do this consistently, like a well-trained dog, it starts to learn what its proper range is. It starts to learn, not through having to get hit by the car, but through being trained by its trainer, going on the road is bad. You know? It starts to learn through being trained by its trainer, look, going off into the neighbor's yard is bad. There's a really big dog there. You know, that dog could bite me. You know, could do me harm. You know? But it also learns what's beneficial to do. It learns, okay, I've got this big backyard here. I can explore in this backyard. I can have fun in this backyard. I can play in this backyard. You know, so long as I don't cross outside my proper range. So long as I don't leave the fenced-in area and run out onto the road, run into the neighbor's yard. And so in the same way, when we're training our minds to stay with the breath, there are things we can do to play with the breath, you know. It's not just the case that the dog has to be on some short leash where it's just next to a pole all the time, you know. Actually, it has to. These young puppies, they have to wander out in the world a bit to learn how to interact with it, right? They've got to dig up the soil. They've got to go smelling things. You know, that's how they develop, you know. That's how they learn about cause and effect. That's how they learn to grow into grown dogs that are able to interact with their environment in a mature way. And in the same way, when we chain our mind to our breath, when we yoke it to our breath, when we leash it to our breath, we can also give ourselves a little bit of room to play. So there's not just what's going on here. We saw we went through all the different spots in our body, you know, trying to relax them, you know. There's things we can do to manipulate our breath. Right there we learn our breath isn't just something that comes in and out of our lungs. You know, when we change our imagination to imagine ourselves breathing in and out through every pore, how does that affect the breath energy in the body? Does it make it more pleasant? Does it make it more tight? Yeah. When we ask ourselves where is a really comfortable place to breathe from, how does that affect our breath energy? And all this is like this dog wandering in the yard learning to play, learning to dig up here and there, you know, learning to scamper around so long as it stays within its range. And in the same way, so long as we stay within our range, our proper range, we stay focused on the breath, you know, then our mind doesn't get into these dangerous places. It doesn't go shooting off to the past. It doesn't go shooting off to the future. But there's also a lot of fun we can have right here, learning about cause and effect with our breath. You know? And it's not dangerous. So the nice thing about this is that when a dog becomes, you know, not to compare our minds to dogs too much, this just seemed to be the metaphor I landed on today. But when a dog becomes mature, you know, when a dog becomes well-trained, that dog, I've seen dogs go on to subway cars, you know. I've seen dogs sleep under, you know, being totally calm, staying under the seats on the TTC on rush hour almost, you know, when there's just tons of people, there's no space. And there's this huge, like, 100-pound dog taking up the space under three seats, you know? And the guy's like, come on, sit down, he won't bite you. Everybody's like, I don't know. But anyways, people eventually sit down and they realize this dog is very well-trained. And in the same way, when our mind's well-trained, we can take it into tight spaces like this, you know? We can take it into difficult situations. And when it's in those difficult situations and we tell it, don't bite, don't run around, don't get yourself in trouble, it does what we say. All from having trained it. You know? So this is why the Buddha says, you know, speak or act with a pure mind and happiness follows you as your shadow unshakable. You know, speak or act with an impure mind and trouble follows you like the wheel follows the cart. Because our thoughts, you know, our intentions precede everything that happens to us. You know? So this is one of the things that we can do. This is one of the things that we can take away, is that our mind is not a given. You know, our mind isn't some kind of fixed entity that we just have, and it's ourself, and it's that way, and it'll never change. You know, it's something that we can train. You know, it's something that we can make better or worse. You know, it's something that we can make like one of these well-trained dogs. You know, it can do all kinds of things. It can lead blind people. You know, it can provide a nice companion for us when we're alone. There's nobody else there. It's nice to be with. You know, have something there. You know, it can it can sniff things out for us. You know, it can detect bombs. I haven't heard about some dogs that can detect cancer if they're well trained enough. By smelling. The mind is actually even more versatile than all that. You know, so this is what we can do. We can train it well, so it becomes a good companion for us. You know, in the same way, some of these dogs. You know, when I walk on Pindapot, some of these dogs are actually really scary. You know, I wouldn't want to cuddle up with them. You know, kind of they're kind of sitting there on their ready to bite you. You know. And we can make our mind like that, you know, if we don't treat it properly. If we let our mind rush out to wherever it wants, bite on whatever it wants, it becomes like this dog, you know, standing at the base of its property, just ready to bite whoever's around, you know. And if there's nobody around, it might bite its owner, you know. And the same thing with our minds, you know. So this is what we come to do when we sit down to watch our breath. It seems like something, you know, can be boring, you know, can be something simple, but it's just like training any animal, you know, training our mind. It has the same principles behind it, you know. We learn to stop it when it's into a dangerous territory, you know. We learn to encourage it when it's doing something good. We learn to cultivate these wholesome thoughts. We learn to cultivate these wholesome intentions, and gradually we learn to develop skills in our mind. So that our mind becomes like a well-trained, you know, dog. Sorry, I've settled on this metaphor. I have to keep going with it. So we tell it to heal, it heals. You know, we tell it to stay, it stays. We tell it to sit, and it sits. You know? And a dog like that is a good companion, which is why they used to call it, you know, they used to call it man's best friend, person's, humanity's best friend. You know, because they can be a companion for you when all else is bad. That dog is there wagging its tail. It's happy to be with you. You know. And in the same way, when our mind is well-trained, it becomes bright, you know? Irrespective of our external situations, irrespective of whatever difficulty we might be going through, it learns what its proper range is, it learns what its proper range isn't, you know? And it's bright throughout it all. You know? So this is a possibility, one of them. Actually, it's even a lower possibility than what the Buddha describes for training our mind. But it's something we can achieve, you know? Through sitting down and watching our breath, through cultivating giving, through cultivating virtue, through making ourselves good people, and through practicing meditation. You know, we can find a happiness like this. Okay, so I think I'll leave that for your reflection. That was actually, we're at 8:25. So we can finish with some chanting, and then if anybody has any questions, I won't have gone over my limit if we're already finished, because then whoever wants to go can go, okay? So if anybody needs to head out, please feel free. And if there's any questions anybody has, please feel free to ask. And if there's no questions, that's no problem as well. But I like questions, so please don't be shy if there are any.
I was wondering, like, do you recommend getting something like this at home, like a statue or?
Yeah, it's probably, it can be good.
Yeah.
In the Buddha's time, there actually weren't any Buddha statues.
Yeah, okay.
It's something that we can use to develop a sense of kind of like devotion and faith. And these are kind of actually very important qualities that tie into meditation. So you kind of clean it, you know, clean it basically every week. You wipe the Buddha down with a special cloth. You put it in a high place.
Yeah, I was wondering about like what are some of the appropriate, like you wouldn't have it in a bedroom, I think, or doesn't matter what.
You could. But you put it like in an appropriate place. If you have a separate room in your house or apartment, that's even better. And then you basically treat it with respect.
And like, do you know where you would get something like a where you could get some?
I think there's a lot of shops online. And okay. There's also one downtown.
Okay, you,
yeah, but I think Temple maybe has some more, like extra stuff.
Oh, I mean, I don't know, but Temple, you would know.
If not, like, I have one extra, so I can.
Oh, I think.
Oh, thanks to Eva. Yeah.
They wouldn't normally keep it in the dining room or the living room because they have some people serve liquor and they don't have to do it in front of the statue.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, they would know. You know, I think you guys would probably know more about the know more about it than me, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, it wasn't on topic on,
no,
on
no.
the talk, but I just...
You can ask about anything, so long as it's about Buddhism. You know, I don't know how to fix cars or anything. Yeah.
A bit confused about how you liken the breath to rewarding the dog.
Mm.
What is the reward in that exploration we did of the breath?
So then when you... I didn't actually describe that in the guided meditation. But when you come back to the breath, you can reward yourself with a really comfortable breath. That's one thing. So you figure out how to breathe in a way that's very comfortable. That's like the dog running out and learning cause and effect by digging in the ground, chewing on things. You know, so you have to figure out how to make your breath. We have to figure out how to make our breath comfortable. And then when our mind comes back, we reward it with an especially comfortable breath. That's one thing we can do. Yeah. But then actually, you know, eventually it's like, you know, like for example, like lifting weights, it seems something really painful, right? But then there's people who, when they lift enough weights, they exercise enough, they become so intimately aware of what the effect of that's going to be down the line. When they're doing it, they're already happy. And then they also get more tuned into the pleasant qualities of exercise. So they get tuned into actually the endorphins. I don't know how to, you know, I'm not a scientist, but they get tuned into the happiness that actually comes from exercise, and they start to enjoy it in and of itself.
They get addicted to it.
Yeah, so they like to do it. So then we can do the same thing, you know, with our breath, right? We start to notice like how we feel before and after meditation. So it starts to be something that ties in, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, kind of like the dog likes to play in his backyard, and then after a while, he doesn't want to go out onto the road. The big noises.
Well, like one issue I have is like when I try to control my breath, I actually feel like I make things worse. Like when I'm trying to interfere and make it be a certain way, I find like it's better when I just get out of the way. You know what I mean? So sometimes when I hear instructions about trying to make the breath a certain way or something, I'm a little apprehensive about that because I know I have a tendency to want to start controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I mean, this is the thing. Basically, any intention that we have is a type of what they call fabrication. So actually, even the intention to just let our breath be the way it is a type of manipulation of the breath. So it's a manipulation of our awareness. And then when we try to manipulate the breath, we don't necessarily, we don't do it as if it was like a dog and we're okay, we want you to, walk beside me. So then we grab the dog and we move each of its feet for it, right? Now you have to do it in an appropriate way. So usually what some teachers describe is you just think it and then you let the body respond after that. So I want my breath to be longer. Then you just think long breath, and then you allow your breath to become longer on its own. So sometimes it needs a really light touch like that, and then other times if there's something really major happening, then you sometimes have to be very coarse, you know, maybe. So if there's you're feeling a huge amount of anger coming up, then sometimes you can actually breathe in and out very deeply, you know? The mind needs like a more coarse object at that time to become, to kind of blot out, you know, the anger, as it were. So there's a variety of different approaches. But if for a particular person, you know, manipulating the breath doesn't produce good results, probably not something they should do, is my understanding. Yeah, until that particular approach starts to produce negative results, then we change that up. Yeah.
Can I ask a question which is not about meditation?
Yeah.
But it bothers me to know. When somebody dies, and 10 years after we give a dharma, are you giving it to the merit to them or doing it for ourselves?
Traditional Buddhist teachings, if that person's been reborn in a ghost world, then they receive the merit from that. Like it affects their body. Yeah, it affects their life. You know, they're kind of the people who are born in those kind of realms. There's these stories about them in in some of the forest traditions, and they've got kind of like their own thing happening there. You know, like they're around and they've got like societies, but they don't have anything. Like they can't get anything. All that they get comes from other people dedicating things to them. So that's what it's like being in that particular realm. So these are like very desperate beings. And they live in these really, you know, like unpleasant places. Like they live under bridges. Like, you know, all these places that people don't want to go to, that's where these beings get attracted to live. Like these really crummy places. You know, in the West, they've got these haunted houses or these kind of ramshackle, you know, houses that these beings live in. And so if somebody's been reborn in that state, then when you dedicate merit to them, which you can do every day, it can affect them in a number of ways. Like it can affect, sometimes they have problems with their physical body. Like if they've done bad karma, they could have actual problems with their, like, you know, their body, and that can actually help heal that up. Sometimes they're like really hungry or really thirsty, and that can provide hunger or thirst. You know, sometimes they're like really cold, you know, like is my understanding, like they have all these problems, like it's not a happy place to be. And so when you dedicate merit to them, it can help alleviate all those problems, depending on what you do. And then if you don't have, that particular person wasn't born there, then it goes to other people, other relatives that you've apparently, the Buddha isn't really specific about that, but it seems like even other relatives you've had throughout samsara, they get it.
You do it for yourself to get merit.
Yeah, you also benefit. It's kind of one of those win-win situations. You know, giving is a win-win. A win-win situation, not a zero-sum situation. So they benefit, and so do we. You know, we also get merit. Yeah.
So thank you forever. Huh? So forever, you will do that forever. Yeah, as long as you live, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah,
you would do give dhanas and stuff like that as long as you want to. There's no time that you say, okay, 10 years, and they can't get it anymore.
Oh, yeah. If they don't get it, other beings do. And it's really tricky. There was a story about a monk named Ajahn Mun, and there's very few monks now like him, but there's still, he had the kind of ability to see all these beings. And so because there were very few monks who could, they would come to him. They would like always be bugging him, you know? And so they were just like these very desperate beings, because imagine, you know, you need these things, but nobody knows about you, you know? There's only a few people you can talk to, like few people you can ask to get your relatives to do stuff. So it's a huge help to them. They're worse off than like homeless people who are like really, they're very bad.
If they're born in a good place, they will go to other people.
Hmm?
If they're born in a good place. Or
yeah, then it goes to other people. Other people there. Yeah.